Lecture number 1, 21st of December 1977, at the Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh Ashram, Pune.
Bhagwan, thus I have heard at one time, the Lord dwelt at Srivasti. Early in the morning the Lord dressed, put on his cloak, took his bowl, and entered the great city of Srivasti to collect alms. When he had eaten and returned from his round, the Lord put away his bowl and cloak, washed his feet, and sat down on the seat arranged for him, crossing his legs, holding his body upright, and mindfully fixing his attention in front of him. Then many monks approached to where the Lord was, saluted his feet with their heads, thrice walked round him to the right, and sat down on one side. At that time the Venerable Subhuti came to the assembly, and sat down. Then he rose from his seat, put his upper robe over one shoulder, placed his right knee on the ground, bent forth his folded hands towards the Lord, and said to the Lord, "It is wonderful, O Lord, it is exceedingly wonderful, O well-gone, how much the Bodhisattvas, the great beings, have been helped with the greatest help by the Tathagata. How then, O Lord, should one who has set out in the Bodhisattva vehicle stand? How progress? How control the thoughts?" After these words, the Lord said to Subhuti, "Therefore, Subhuti, listen well and attentively. Someone who has set out in the vehicle of the Bodhisattva should produce a thought in this manner. As many beings as there are in the universe of beings, comprehended under the term beings, all these must I lead to Nirvana, into that realm of Nirvana which leaves nothing behind. And yet, although innumerable beings have thus been led to Nirvana, no being at all has been led to Nirvana. And why? If in a Bodhisattva the notion of a being should take place, he could not be called a Bodhi being. And why? He is not to be called a Bodhi being in whom the notion of a self or of a being should take place, or the notion of a living soul or of a person."
I love Gautam the Buddha because he represents to me the essential core of religion. He is not the founder of Buddhism. Buddhism is a byproduct. But he is the beginner of a totally different kind of religion in the world. He is the founder of a religionless religion. He has propounded not religion but religiousness. And this is a great radical change in the history of human consciousness. Before Buddha, there were religions, but never a pure religiousness. Man was not yet mature. With Buddha, humanity enters into a mature age. All human beings have not yet entered into that, that's true. But Buddha has heralded the path. Buddha has opened the gateless gate. His message is the deepest ever. Nobody has done the work that Buddha has done, the way he has done. Nobody represents pure fragrance. Other founders of religions, other enlightened people, have compromised with their ideas, Buddha remains uncompromised. Hence his purity. He does not care what you can understand. He cares only what the truth is. And he says it without being worried whether you understand it or not. In a way, this looks harsh. In another way, this is great compassion. Truth has to be said as it is. The moment you compromise, the moment you bring truth to the ordinary level of human consciousness, it loses its soul. It becomes superficial. It becomes a dead thing. You cannot bring truth to the level of human beings. Human beings have to be led to the level of truth. That is Buddha's great work. 25 centuries before, just someday, early morning, just like this day, this sutra was born. Monks were present. It happened in the city of Sravasti. It was a great city of those days. The word Sravasti means the city of glory. It was one of the glorious cities of ancient India. It had 900,000 families in it. Now, that city has completely disappeared. A very, very small village exists. You will not find even its name on any map. Even the name has disappeared. Now it is called Sahet Mahet. It is impossible to believe that such a great city had existed there. This is the way of life. Things go on changing. Cities turn into cemeteries. Cemeteries turn into cities. Life is a flux. Buddha must have loved this city of Sravasti, because out of 45 years of his ministry, he stayed in Sravasti 25 years. He must have loved the people. The people must have been of a very evolved consciousness. All the great sutras of Buddha, almost all were born in Sravasti. This sutra, the Diamond Sutra, was also born in Sravasti. The Sanskrit name of this sutra is Vajra Chedika Pragya Paramita Sutra. It means perfection of wisdom which cuts like a thunderbolt. If you allow, Buddha can cut you like a thunderbolt. He can behead you. He can kill you and help you to be reborn. A Buddha has to be both a murderer and a mother. On the one hand, he has to kill. On another hand, he has to give a new being to you. The new being is possible only when the old has been destroyed. only on the ashes of old, the new is born. Man is a phoenix. The mythological bird, phoenix, is not just a mythology. It is a metaphor. It stands for man. That phoenix nowhere exists except in man. Man is the being who has to die to be reborn. That's what Jesus said to Nicodemus. Nicodemus was a professor, a learned man, a rabbi, a member of the board that controlled the great temple of Jerusalem. One dark night he came to see Jesus. He could not gather courage to come to him in the daytime. He was afraid what people will say. He was so respectful, so much respected, going to a vagabond teacher, going to somebody who is hated by all the rabbis and all the learned people, going to somebody who moves with thieves and drunkards and prostitutes. But something in him was very desirous to see this man. Maybe he had seen Jesus walking, coming to the temple. He must have felt something deep in his unconscious for this man. He could not hold himself. One night when everybody has left, even the disciples had gone to sleep, he reached Jesus and he asked, "What should I do so that I can also enter into the kingdom of God?" And Jesus said, "Unless you die, nothing is possible. If you die, only then you can enter into the kingdom of God. You will have to die as you are. Only then you can be born as really your inner being is. The ego has to die for the essential being to surface." That is the meaning of Pragya Parimita Vajra Chedika. It cuts like thunderbolts. In one stroke, it can destroy you. It is one of the greatest sermons of Buddha. Get in tune with it. Before we enter into the sutra, few things to be understood that will help to understand it. Gautam the Buddha has taught a spirituality that is non-repressive and non-ideological. That is a very rare phenomenon. The ordinary kind of spirituality, the garden variety, is very repressive. It depends on repression. It does not transform man. It only cripples man. It does not liberate man. It enslaves man. It is oppressive. It is ugly. Listen to these words of Thomas A. Kempis, author of Imitation of Christ. He writes, "The more violence you do to yourself, the greater will be your growth in grace. There is no other way save of daily mortification. To despise oneself is the best and the most perfect counsel. There are thousands of saints down the ages who will agree with Thomas A. Kempis. And Thomas A. Kempis is pathological. Or the French priest Bossu says, cursed be the earth, cursed be the earth, a thousand times cursed be the earth. Why? Why the earth should be cursed? Life has to be cursed. These people have been thinking as if God is against life, as if life is against God. Life is God. There is no antagonism. There is no separation even. They are not different things. They are two names for one reality. Remember this, Buddha is non-repressive. And if you find Buddhist monks to be repressive, remember, they have not understood Buddha at all. They have brought their own pathology into his teachings. And Buddha is non-ideological. He gives no ideology. Because all ideologies are of the mind. And if ideologies are of the mind, they cannot take you beyond the mind. No ideology can become a bridge to reach beyond the mind. All ideologies have to be dropped. Only then the mind will be dropped. Buddha believes in no ideals either. Because all ideals create tension and conflict in man. They divide. They create anguish. You are one thing and they want you to be something else. Between these two you are stretched, torn apart. Ideals create misery. Ideals create schizophrenia. The more ideals there are, the more people will be schizophrenic. They will be split. Only a non-ideological consciousness can avoid being split. And if you are split, how you can be happy? How you can be silent? How can you know anything of peace, of stillness? The ideological person is continuously fighting with himself. Each moment there is conflict. He lives in conflict. He lives in confusion. Because he cannot decide who really he is, the ideal or the reality. He cannot trust himself. He becomes afraid of himself. He loses confidence. And once a man loses confidence, he loses all glory. Then he is ready to become a slave to anybody, to any priest, to any politician. Then he is just ready, waiting to fall in some trap. Why people become followers? Why people are trapped? Why people fall for a Joseph Stalin or a Adolf Hitler or a Mao Zedong? Why in the first place? They have become so shaky, the ideological confusion has shaken them from their very roots. Now they cannot stand on their own. They want somebody to lean to. They cannot move on their own. They don't know who they are. They need somebody to tell them that you are this or that, they need an identity to be given to them. They have forgotten their self and their nature. Adolf Hitler's and Joseph Stalin's and Mao Zedong's will be coming again and again, until and unless man drops all ideologies. And remember, when I say all ideologies, I mean all ideologies. I don't make any distinction between noble ideologies and not so noble. All ideologies are dangerous. In fact, the noble ideologies are more dangerous. Because they have more seductive power. They are more persuasive. But ideology as such is a disease, exactly a dis-ease, because you become two, the ideal and you. And the you that you are is condemned, and the you that you are not is praised. Now you are getting into trouble. Now sooner or later you will be neurotic, psychotic or something. Buddha has given a non-repressive way of life and non-ideological too. That's why he does not talk about God. He does not talk about heaven. He does not talk about any future. He does not give you anything to hold. He takes everything away from you. He takes even yourself. He goes on taking things away. And finally, he takes even the idea of self, I, ego. He leaves only pure emptiness behind. And this is very difficult. This is very difficult because we have completely forgotten how to give. We only know how to take. We go on taking everything. I take the exam, and I take the wife, and I take even the afternoon nap. You go on taking. Even afternoon nap, you take a thing which cannot be taken. You have to surrender to it. Sleep comes only when you surrender. Even a wife, a husband, you go on taking. You are not respectful. The wife is not a property. You can take a house. How can you take a wife or a husband? But our language shows our mind. We don't know how to give. How to give in. How to let go. How let things happen. Buddha takes all ideals away, the whole future away. And finally, he takes the last thing that is very, very difficult for us to give. He takes your very self, leaves a pure, innocent, virgin emptiness behind. That virgin emptiness he calls nirvana. Nirvana is not a goal. It is just your emptiness. When you have dropped all that you have accumulated, when you don't hold any more, when you are no more a miser and a clinger, then suddenly that emptiness erupts. It has always been there. Hakun is right. From the very beginning, all beings are Buddhas. That emptiness is there. You have accumulated junk, so that emptiness is not visible. It is just like in your house, you can go on accumulating things. Then you stop seeing any space. Then there is no more space. A day comes, even to move in the house becomes difficult. To live becomes difficult because there is no space. But space has not gone anywhere. Think of it. Meditate over it. The space has not gone anywhere. You have accumulated too much furniture in the TV and the radio and the radiogram and the piano and everything. But the space has not gone anywhere. Remove the furniture out and the space is there. It has always been there. It was hidden by the furniture, but it was not destroyed. It has not left the room, not for a single moment. So is your inner emptiness, your nirvana, your nothingness. Buddha does not give you nirvana as an ideal. Buddha liberates instead of coercing. Buddha teaches you how to live, not for any goal, not to achieve anything, but to be blissful here now. How to live in awareness. Not that awareness is going to give you something. Awareness is not a means to anything. It is the end in itself. The means and the end both. Its value is intrinsic. Buddha does not teach you otherworldliness. This has to be understood. People are worldly. The priests go on teaching the other world. The other world is also not very otherworldly. It cannot be. Because it is just an improved model of the same world. From where you can create the other worlds, you know only this world. You can improve. You can decorate the other world better. You can remove few things that are ugly here and you can replace few things which you think will be beautiful. But it is going to be a creation out of the experience of this world. So your other world is not very different. Cannot be. It is a continuity. It comes out of your mind. It is a game of imagination. You will have beautiful women there. Of course, more beautiful than you have here. You will have the same kinds of pleasures there. Maybe more permanent, stable. But they will be the same kind of pleasures. You will have better food, more tasty, but you will have food. You will have houses, maybe made of gold, but they will be houses. You will repeat the whole thing again. Just go into the scriptures and see how they depict the heaven. And you will find the same world improved upon. Few touches here and few touches there. But it is not in any way otherworldly. That's why I say the otherworldliness of other religions is not much otherworldly. It is this world projected in the future. It is born out of the experience of this world. There will not be misery and poverty and illness and paralysis and blindness and deafness. Things that you don't like here will not be there, and things that you like will be here and in abundance. But it is not going to be anything new. Mind cannot conceive of anything new. Mind is incapable of conceiving the new. Mind lives in the old. Mind is the old. The new never happens through the mind. The new happens only when mind is not functioning, when mind is not controlling you, when mind has been put aside. The new happens only when the mind is not interfering. But all your scriptures talk about the heaven, and the heaven or the paradise or Firdaus or Swarga is nothing. But the same story may be printed on a better art paper, with better ink, in a more improved press, with more colorful illustrations. But the story is the same. It cannot be otherwise. Buddha does not talk of other worldliness or the other worlds. He simply teaches you how to be here in this world, how to be here alert, conscious, mindful, so that nothing impinges upon your emptiness, so that your inner emptiness is not culminated, poisoned, so that you can live here and yet remain uncontaminated, unpolluted, so that you can be in the world and the world will not be in you.